Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs here at Princeton University. And this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi, Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So of all the issues that have really, I think, shaped the last decade, one of the top has been the challenge of climate change. And we've heard a lot of discussion in the press and among scholars about climate change. We've seen a very fierce battle unfold in Washington with very little success in many ways at gaining traction, at putting into place regulations to deal with this problem. Many of the regulations that are put into place or have been put into place have been slowly dismantled under President Trump's administration. And equally problematic for many has been this counter-narrative to the problem that science has documented very effectively about what's going on with the environment, an anti-climate change discourse. And then another issue, which I think has captured a lot of attention, has been economic inequality and the growing divide between the rich and the poor. Movements such as Occupy Wall Street obviously spoke about this. Senator Bernie Sanders made this a central theme of his primary challenge to Hillary Clinton. And there's been best-selling books unexpectedly, really, on this issue that suggest this is something of concern to broad parts of the population, and some experts have attributed President Trump's appeal to his ability to speak to those in this country who are economically disaffected. And I'd throw another issue that is lower on the radar but will be part of our discussion, and that has to do with the challenges of urbanization and where cities go today and in the next few years, where both these issues, climate change and economic inequality, have in fact been front and center. Today we have with us to discuss this Ashley Dawson, a professor of English at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, who's currently a visiting scholar here at the Princeton Environmental Institute. And he is the author of a new book, Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change, which was published by Verso and has been named by Publishers Weekly as one of the top 10 books of 2017. So welcome to our show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Could you talk, you start the book with a personal account of Hurricane Sandy, and you use this to open up your discussions. Can you tell us why you start with Hurricane Sandy and what that has to do with the theme of the book?
I wanted to begin with my own experience of living in a city that was affected by such a dramatic hurricane, and not just any city, New York City, the capital of capital. I mean, if any city should be adequately prepared, one would think, for all of the storms that are bearing down upon urban life around the globe, it should be New York City. But what Hurricane Sandy really revealed was that we were manifestly ill-prepared. And so I wanted to show how that played out in my own experience, you know, with water coming in through the mortar of my building and creating this huge blister in the paint and keeping me up all night mopping, but of course not being life-threatening ultimately. And then I sort of pan out from my own experience in Jackson Heights to the experience of people in other neighborhoods across New York in the financial district, where water came and flooded many buildings, but where there were lots of economic resources to have a quick bounce back. And then in Red Hook, which is a community with many low-income people, people of color, and with vast public housing, which was very detrimentally affected and which is still struggling to come back from the effects of Hurricane Sandy. So I wanted to show how the city was fragmented and unequal, and climate change was going to really affect cities around the world along those lines very unequally. So we shouldn't just think of kind of bouncing back a city as a whole to the conditions it was before. We need instead to really think about how we need to change cities so that in making them climate proof for the challenges to come, we also cope with inequalities, because it's those inequalities which make us really vulnerable.
And a basic question which is at the heart of your book, in the capital of capital, as you just said, a city of enormous wealth, enormous resources, why doesn't the city's elite feel the need to, in some ways, waterproof the entire city from these kinds of problems and to put into place policies that are effective for everyone? What accounts for this discrepancy?
What I try and show in the book is that after Hurricane Sandy, there were many efforts to ameliorate the city's conditions. I mean, if you go down to the ferry terminal at the bottom of Manhattan at Battery Park, you can see that in the entrance to the subway that was flooded, there are now these huge storm doors which can be closed to stop the subway system flooding as it did after Hurricane Sandy. But, you know, those kinds of efforts, as important as they are still relatively piecemeal, and they've left many communities behind. And so what I try and show in the book is that while there have been significant efforts, at the same time, there are forces which sort of militate against making sure the whole city is protected. And those have to do with enduring forms of inequality, particularly racial and class inequality in the city, so that populations are really being left behind. I mean, just to give one very concrete instance of this, I talk about the Rebuild by Design competition, which was funded by HUD and by the Rockefeller Foundation to try and come up with very imaginative architectural solutions and urban planning solutions to the kinds of weaknesses that Hurricane Sandy showed. One of the projects is in the South Bronx, where there's a huge food distribution market for basically over 20 million people in the region. So there were plans developed to put up berms and to landscape them so that they could be public amenities as well as protecting the neighborhood. But communities in that area pointed out that the protective infrastructure which was being built was only going to protect certain areas, and those are the areas where capital was concentrated, you know, where this big food distribution site was located, and areas right next door, which were, again, poor communities that have been coping with disproportionate forms of environmental degradation and damage for many decades, they were all left behind. There was absolutely no planning to protect them. So there's a real way in which the development of the city by elites, both today and over the last few decades, has really left many communities highly vulnerable.
So New York City has some unusual features that probably I'm kind of curious to get your take on this. New York City is a city of a lot of inequality, right? Inequality is on the rise in the United States. And the United States, generally speaking, is riven by political divisions about climate change. So to what extent are these problems that you're describing in the Bronx or what have you, how much of this is specific to New York or specific to the United States? Are other cities dealing in a more rational way with these issues that that play out somewhat differently than your direct experience?
I think that in New York City, there isn't the same kind of climate change denial playing that we see on a national stage.
But national policies are not exactly coordinated towards dealing with climate change. So it is in a national environment where that's not present.
Yeah, no.
But anyway, keep on going, though. I don't want to...
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Mayor Bloomberg, I think, used the idea of the green city to try and market New York City, and was drawing on some of the initiatives which he saw other cities embracing and pioneering, and wanted to make New York City really at the center of those kinds of policies. So to a certain extent, many of the dynamics playing out in New York City are reflective of things that are happening in other places. But as you pointed out, New York City is an extremely wealthy city, also an extremely unequal city. So what's happening in New York doesn't necessarily what's happening in cities throughout the world. And I want to be very cognizant in my book of the gap between cities in the global north and the global south, you know, cities in areas that were once colonized and that have been struggling to develop for quite some time, and a city like New York City. And so in many of those cities in the global south, people are finding themselves extremely vulnerable as a result of being forced to settle in slums and other areas that are highly vulnerable to forms of climate change-related damage, you know, whether it's floods, which we've been talking about in the context of Hurricane Sandy, or drought, which is affecting all of southern Africa right now, you know, and increasing famine as a result of the difficulty of gaining access to food. You know, urbanites, in most cases, can't grow their own food. So this is an increasing problem globally.
But you, you're somewhat, how should I put it, you're critical of the concept of a green city to begin with. So even if New York were a model city. So let's hear about that.
Yeah. Well, I think that the idea of the green city is one that has some virtue to it. There's a book by David Owen that talks about New York City as a paradigm of what urbanization should be about. And he argues that it's because New York City is highly concentrated and because there's a functioning public transportation infrastructure that the average New Yorker has a very low carbon footprint, and that this is the way that cities in the rest of the United States and, of course, the rest of the world should be developing. So New York becomes a kind of paradigm of the green city. And, of course, Mayor Bloomberg built on that by building bike lanes and marketing New York City as a green city. But the problem with that kind of analytic is that it ignores the fact that there are many people living in New York City who are extremely wealthy and who have second or third or fourth homes and who are flying all over the world. And the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, New York City is the capital of capital, right? So Wall Street is there. And the kind of economic base of the city often involves forms of development around the rest of the planet that are highly unsustainable. You know, the big banks that are bankrolling fossil fuel development in various parts of the world. So I think when you talk about the green city, you need to take these other bigger dimensions into consideration rather than drawing a kind of arbitrary limit around the city borders and saying people here all have low carbon footprints.
I want to ask a follow-up question to that, but I'm going to interject with myself. Under Mayor de Blasio, has there been any progress on some of these issues, given his politics lean much more to the left, or is there more of a status quo situation?
When de Blasio came into power, he changed the kind of overarching plan that New York had for coping with climate change from Plan NYC to One City. And you can kind of hear in the change of the name that there's an effort to cope with inequality that's really basic to what he's trying to do. So he has put forward a number of initiatives that have been quite important. I mean, think about universal free pre-K, for instance, mm-hmm. in addressing the city's galloping and deepening inequalities. But in terms of really turning around some of the unsustainable patterns of urbanization, there's a lot more to be done, right? So while he has, I think, quite path-breaking initiative to force buildings to retrofit and diminish their carbon emissions, there's no moratorium on coastal development around New York City. You know, there's no plan to help communities who are relatively poor and in endangered areas of the city cope with what the future is going to bring. So there are lots of problems still, and he's received quite a lot of criticism.
So it would seem, I mean, listening to you and reading the book, on the one hand, you have this structural problem of inequality, and that creates pockets of powerful pockets of wealth, which are driving some of the inadequate response or detrimental policies toward the climate. And then very specific in New York, I'm listening to you, there is the power of the real estate industry, which seems in concrete terms what you're talking about. And it's been an issue with Mayor de Blasio, for example, where many critics have said he's not nearly as progressive as he should be. Is that the engine or a driving engine in terms of this problem that you're recounting in New York?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. So in the book, I try and give a history of New York City going back to the 1970s and how essentially what we've seen over the last few decades has been the rise of real estate, but also finance and insurance. It's often called FIRE industry, right? Giving an acronym to those different industries. And it's not just that they have disproportionate economic power in the city. It's also that they essentially engineered a kind of de facto coup over city government in the 1970s during the fiscal crisis. And the power of city unions and social movements has never really been able to overcome the power of those very elite vested interests. And de Blasio's election was a result of a kind of pushback against that elite power, but it's a partial victory, and he is constrained in a lot of different ways and hasn't come through in enough ways.
So why isn't it in their interest to prevent New York City from becoming a dystopian hellhole? because, you know, if I live in New York City and I'm hyper-rich, I think I don't want to live in a dystopian hellhole.
Yeah, right. No, it's true. Well, at the moment, the response of elites, and this is true not just in New York City, but on a national level, seems to be to turn to a kind of popular authoritarianism, you know, to embrace a crackdown on discontent of various different kinds while trying to make as much money hand over fist as possible, right? So, you know, you
move into a taller tower.
Yeah, move into a taller tower. You know, these are not people who need to take out 30-year mortgages, right? You know, they can buy a condo in Miami Beach and flip it after a year or two, and it's a good investment, right? Or build a luxury condo and sell it and then get out very quickly. So their timeline is not the timeline that the average person in the city has, and it's certainly not the timeline that scientists have. And even the science is problematic, right? Because we get projections for sea level rise going out to 2100, but obviously the sea is not going to stop rising at 2100. I mean, even if we manage to engage in rapid carbon mitigation so that we get levels of warming down pretty quickly, the energy we put into the oceans is going to keep melting those glaciers for hundreds of years. The sea levels are going to keep rising. So, yeah, the timeline of capital is...
Isn't Miami going to be in, like, underwater?
Yes, yeah. It is. It is definitely going to be
looking for some inland place in Florida.
Well,
or the Florida Islands, as we are going to call them.
Yeah, good luck with that. I think the high point in southern Florida is about 6 feet high above sea level. Yeah, no, the promises of all of the major nations for the United Nations climate process were to raise the temperature basically based on these voluntary agreements, no more than 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, we found out at the recent Bonn Climate Summit that none of the major nations are sticking to those promises, so they're failing. But even if they were sticking to them, we'd be melting enough glacier that the bottom third of Florida is going underwater by 2100. And of course, before that happens, there are going to be increasingly strong storms and other forms of climate chaos. So,
are the problems in New York comparable? I mean, Sam asked you about how representative it is, but to smaller cities in the United States, even neighboring cities like a city like Trenton or Camden in New Jersey, do they have the same kind of dynamic that you're talking about in a place like New York, or is it different?
No, that's a fascinating question. I think that New York has access to disproportionate resources in some ways, and so it's a city that's been growing in terms of population and is dealing with massive gentrification as a result of that. And so those dynamics may be somewhat different from cities in other parts of the U.S. and certainly other parts of the world, where the reasons people are coming to cities are different, and the challenges that cities have in terms of financing some kind of mitigation or adaptation policies are very, very different, much steeper in some ways.
And then you have this really interesting idea. I think you titled the chapter of a book of the book Climate Apartheid. And so I guess that leads to the question of all of these different phenomena that you're talking about within the cities. Is this simply policy laziness, meaning we're just not doing anything about the structures that we have and the damage that's being caused? Or is there more intentionality in concentrating resources in certain areas, throwing hands up on development that's detrimental? How do you see it? How much of a causal story is there behind the city's elite?
Well, certainly climate change denial is a conscious policy, right? You know, I mean, big fossil fuel-based corporations, we know from research that has been done, are employing exactly the same strategies which big tobacco used. In fact, they're employing exactly the same marketing firms to spread doubt and uncertainty and then to use that conjured up doubt and uncertainty to justify policy inaction on climate change and mitigation.
That's so, in the U.S. Like, that, is that the case in other countries?
No, I mean, the U.S. is a real outlier in terms of the strength of the climate change denial industry. And, you know, the U.S. is also a real outlier, I would argue, in terms of the corruption of its political system. And that's why it's so possible for climate change denial to gain so much purchase over our electoral system. It's because big money plays such a strong role here, which it doesn't play in many other democracies, for instance, in many European countries. I mean, that's not that there isn't an effort to do that. But another way also to answer your question, Julian, is to also think about the ways in which the Trump administration's xenophobia and overt racism is a kind of strategy to react to the situation we find on the ground. I mean, in the climate apartheid chapter, I argue that climate change is going to displace more and more people, not just
climate refugees.
Yeah, not just Floridians. And right now,
well, Syrians, right? Like, famine in Syria leads to displacement of Syrians. I mean, that doesn't get talked about that much. But, you know, like resource scarcity is a thing that makes people run away, makes people angry. I mean, you know, like, there's, like, just to change, to pivot to something else just for a brief moment, like, people talk about economic anxiety as driving the concerns of Rust Belt voters, and then this gets put up as something that's in conflict with the idea of white racism in those places. But when resources get scarce, these feelings come out, and so climate creates situations with scarcity all over the place, Syria, you know, and maybe here at home.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that that's right. And in the climate apartheid chapter, I talk about the fact that there is one branch of the government which is not engaged in denial and is thinking about the future very, very carefully, and that's the U.S. military. So a kind of security-oriented solution, which is about ramping up borders and controlling population movements in response to, the impacts of climate change is certainly something that a part of the government is thinking about. But we now have the Trump administration, which is very much playing this kind of racist card. And we've seen the same kind of thing happening in Europe, right? In response to fleeing Syrians, there's this rise of neo-fascist movements, some of which have gained political power in parts of the European Union. So I think that there are real dangers, right? On the one hand, with kind of big capital engaging in this climate change denial in order to keep pursuing policies that don't make any sense unless you have huge amounts of stock in ExxonMobil. And then on the other hand, this sort of slide towards climate change-based xenophobia and racism. And we've seen this kind of collaboration between big capital and fascism happen before in the 20th century. It's not a happy history.
You said, this is incredible, that in 2012, that's the Hurricane Sandy year, 32 million people around the world were forced into temporary or permanent, either temporarily or permanently, from their homes because of extreme weather. An estimated 776,000 people across 24 states in the U.S. were displaced by Hurricane Sandy.
That's, I wonder what that would be this year.
Incredible.
With the series of hurricanes in Houston and
Puerto
Rico.
In general, so, but when you're talking about a hurricane, it's short-term displacement, or obviously with Katrina, some of this turn. So it can vary.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this part of the problem is the statistics and how all this gets recorded, right? I mean, as the previous point that we were talking about suggests, there's a lot of concern about climate refugees coming from less developed countries to the global north. But the vast majority of people are displaced within their own countries, maybe going from the countryside to a city or from one city to the next. Where we really get recording of statistics is when poor people are coming from a place like Haiti or a place like Syria to the European Union or the U.S. But the statistics are really shocking. I mean, just as a result of the heavy monsoons this last summer and early fall, over 41 million people were displaced in South Asia in countries like Nepal and Bangladesh. I mean, 41 million people. And you know, I haven't read any reports of whether they've been able to go back and what kind of support they've gotten for returning home.
And so at the heart of your book is this connection between the two issues that I started discussing that seem to be treated separately. So you have the environmental movement and you have those concerned with economic inequality. And you are arguing that treating these separately is almost quixotic, that in the end you're missing the structural factors that are causing many of the problems. Is that right? Or?
Yeah, that's it exactly. And not just that, I would also argue that in order to have a genuine solution to climate change problems, there also has to be a kind of social justice or economic justice solution, right? And that's in terms of just the kind of material questions. You know, we need to have a really massive and rapid transition to renewable energy, and the free market is not doing that. It's not going to do it in enough time, and it's not going to do it on a large enough scale. So we really need to have massive jobs programs for a huge shift. And Obama's Green New Deal didn't do it, right? And one reason the AFL-CIO is not supporting Trump and more pipelines in the Dakotas is because they feel like the Obama administration threw them under the bus, essentially. So we need to have this really rapid kind of material transformation. But the key to solving these issues politically is by promising people not that carbon is going to be reduced, which, you know, the person who needs to eat and find a job really doesn't care about. It seems very, very remote to them, but promising them good jobs and a kind of economic future.
Well, let me make a Federalist argument here. So the Trump administration has people like Scott Pruitt, who are very unfriendly to issues of environmental protection, in charge of the EPA. But here's a counterargument. It's a good time for this kind of action. Maybe this is your argument, too. Because, in fact, the administration is notably incompetent and gaining a lot of its goals. The administration wanted a big cut to climate research at the EPA. There was very little or no cut. The administration would like to implement policies, can't really get any no legislation in Congress in the last 10 months. But what they are is polarizing. And so if what one wants is action, this is a good time because state and local organizations, cities, don't have to be shackled by the national government. The genius of the American system is federalism. At least that's what I saw in my textbooks when I was a kid. And so if we believe that that system is still strong in the United States, then there are many opportunities for action, and it's more a question. You know, it's a great opportunity. Imagine if a more competent administration were in charge of national economic environmental policy. That would be, in fact, presumably. My guess is you think that would be worse than what we have now.
Yeah, no, it's true. When people talk about potential impeachment of Trump and his replacement with Mike Pence, it does sort of send chills to down one's spine because
I'm not convinced that he would be more competent because isn't he the one who's sort of pulling the strings here? I mean,
right.
who picked all those cabinet officers?
Perhaps that's true.
But anyway, go on.
The specter of an actually competent politician taking over from the erratic Trump is in some ways equally terrifying as Trump's erraticness. But there is something to what you're saying, I think, Sam, and it's definitely true. I mentioned the Bonn Climate Summit previously, and the potential for state governments and cities to forge a different path from the climate change denial, which Trump is all about, was pretty apparent. You know, there was a huge big tent at Bonn set up by the We Are Still In Coalition, and they touted the fact that they're actually living up to the promises of the Paris Agreement.
But there's categories here. There's contributing to carbon footprint and pollution, and then there's creating city environments where people can live, and those are kind of different things, right? So, for instance, New York is, by some measures, said to be a relatively green city in the United States, but it can still be a cruddy place for people to live, say, in the South Bronx.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. I guess I was just trying to think about your argument about federalism, and in some ways, We Are Still In Coalition is made up of cities and states that are on the coasts. So if you're thinking about adaptation and places where people are imperiled by at least by sea level rise, the We Are Still In Coalition, or the also called the Climate Alliance, really is on the front lines of danger in terms of sea level rise. And they're basically moving forward with their promises to cut emissions. The estimates are that they're down in California, New York, and the other 14 states in the Climate Alliance by between 24 and 29% carbon emissions. The problem is that the Climate Alliance is only 36% of the U.S. population. So there are all the other states that are not cutting their emissions, and they need to be brought on board, obviously. And then the other problem—
Well, if you make that about jobs, it might get better traction because people in those places are not going to buy into the climate change idea.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's true. You know, so in a place like West Virginia, there's a lot of bitterness over the failure of the Democrats to live up to some of their problems, their promises of job creation. So we really need to have a very significant shift in that regard. And that's why the federal government has to be part of it. That's why we can't just rely on the kind of federalist model of states and cities doing things alone, not just because of population numbers, but because we really need this massive transformation. I mean, we need to create a national energy grid rather than the kind of fragmented one that we have now. And that's because we need to be able to, and this is kind of, I don't want to get too wonky about the technical elements, but, you know, if we're going to have really significant parts of renewable energy in the grid, we have to have a very big grid so that when it's sunny in one part of the country or when it's windy in one part of the country, that energy can be used in a part of the country where it's not sunny or windy. Right. So if you have a small grid, that's not going to happen. So we really need to change things and to have the federal government making those kinds of changes. I mean, a lot of the cuts that I was alluding to earlier that the alliance has been able to do is because of the replacement of coal-fired power plants by liquid natural gas-fired power plants. That's a solution which doesn't get us to really radical mitigation, really radical cuts in carbon emissions. So the really hard work is still to be done, and it's going to have to involve federal engagement.
So one of the things that jumps off the page of your book is the biography page, or the back flap, meaning you're a professor of English. And here you've taken a deep dive into environmental policy and history, and in fact, I think
energy grid policy.
Energy grid policy, and I think my sense of you through the book, you're arguing not simply making an argument about what has to happen, but how we even have to understand what the problem is through many disciplinary lenses. So, can you speak just a few minutes about yourself as an English professor writing this big book on climate change and urbanization and economic policy? What brings you into that realm, and how do you think about what you're doing in terms of disciplines?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. I'm very aware of the fact that I'm an English professor, and sometimes I feel like a bit of a dilettante, but I come from a background in postcolonial studies, so I've always been aware of and interested in thinking about global inequality and about resistance movements to global inequality. I'm originally from South Africa. My family left during the apartheid era, so I don't have much of an accent left. But, you know, the background of resistance to apartheid and racism is the kind of formation of a lot of my thoughts. It drove my scholarship previously, and it was behind this book. Living in New York City since basically 1990, I've been very aware of the challenges that people in New York City have faced. I mean, Julian, at the outset, you talked about increasing inequality in the city and, of course, you know, issues around stop and frisk and the kind of adverse impact of heavy-handed policing on city populations has been just so much a part of my consciousness. And then, of course, after 9/11, the way that social justice movements and civic movements were clamped down upon in the name of security, and the way that people tried to resist that was very apparent to me. And part of all of that was struggles for environmental justice, right? So, you know, the ways in which communities of color were being dispossessed throughout this period by increasing gentrification and were also facing disproportionate burdens environmentally, right? So I went to Columbia as a grad student, and I started, as I said, in the late 80s, early 90s, and that was when there was a big struggle going on by one of the most important environmental justice organizations in New York. It's called We Act, and it's based in Harlem, and they were fighting against the location of a sewage treatment plant in the Harlem River, just to the west of Harlem, which was emitting all sorts of toxic air and really poisoning the local community, right? So I was very aware of those kinds of struggles and the way in which many of those environmental justice organizations grew out of the civil rights struggle, were fighting in communities to ameliorate their conditions, but then didn't just stay locally based. I mean, what happened as I became more and more active in environmental issues, I started attending the Conference of Parties meetings, you know, where United Nations climate conversations happen. And there were always these amazing counter-mobilizations, kind of counter-summits that brought together activists from all over the world. And I found organizations like We Act from Harlem going there and taking on real leadership roles in talking about what kind of transition they'd like to see. And it was always a transition which would ameliorate environmental conditions. But as we've been talking about, it was one that was trying to also deal with employment questions, inequality, and really transform communities and make the city more egalitarian.
Let me take this, let me take Julian's question in a slightly different direction, which is that just speaking as a scientist who sticks his nose into things, I'm curious, to what extent do you think that it's important to use technical knowledge, environmental science, climate research, those kinds of energy research? Do you have anything to say to either activists in this domain or your colleagues who maybe are not so into energy grids? Talk about the role of technical information and how you go about doing what you do.
No, I think it's absolutely essential to build coalitions. And
I see. So you actually don't want to have the technical knowledge yourself. You're going to go find somebody who has it. Is that it?
Well, I would not be so hubristic as to claim that I'm going to be able to understand, you know, the climate science by myself. No, and not making any kind of contribution to, you know, projections about sea level rise. But I've been very lucky in the course of writing the book to meet some amazing scientists who are doing that work, and to become apparent. To become aware of the fact that there's a real dialogue within the scientific community, you know. So I met, for instance, Hal Wanless in Florida, who was quite critical of the projections of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Oh, yeah? What did he think?
Well, he was basically saying that scientists can be quite conservative, and this, to a certain extent, in terms of the IPCC projections, was as a result of a lot of the political flack they were getting. So because they didn't know what the exact melt rates for Antarctica and Greenland were, they completely factored out the melting of those areas from projections in some of the initial reports.
I think scientists should at least do things in Fahrenheit, because, you know, when people talk about 1.8 to 4 degree changes in temperature in the next 100 years, which is, I think, the IPCC range, you know, that is like 4 to 7 degrees. That's bad. Okay, this is like 4 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit. This is like a serious change in temperature environment, but at a minimum, when dealing with Americans, I don't know, there just seems to be a lot of communication that needs to happen there.
Yeah, I mean, but what's interesting, and I guess this was originally what was in my mind, and we have to wrap up in a second, the fact you aren't, it's not that you're not on the inside, but you come from this very different perspective, for me, is very refreshing and probably opens up your interpretation to a problem like this in ways that a scientist might not be thinking of, or even an environmental activist who's totally locked into some of the familiar narratives about what the problems are. They might not be looking at, you know, the structure of real estate and finance in cities as opposed to regulations on carbon emission. And so I think that's probably part of what animates the book and is part of what makes the contribution.
Oh, thank you. No, I mean, I feel very fortunate to have been able to be part of a lot of different conversations and a lot of different worlds and learn from a lot of different people as I've been writing this book.
So we are out of time, but thanks again to Ashley Dawson, who's visiting this year at the Princeton Environmental Institute, is also a professor of English at City University of New York, and he is the author of Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change, with Verso Books, and is available everywhere, and as we said at the beginning, was named by Publishers Weekly as one of the top 10 books of 2017. So thanks for joining our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that wraps up our episode. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.